Hi, everyone, and welcome to a Juno Afternoon for today on this cold, getting to be windy Friday. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today. And today we're going to be talking to Forest Service entomologist Elizabeth Graham. She's going to be tonight's fireside speaker at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. She's going to be talking about insects and spruce trees, and we're going to talk to her about that. Robert Venables will be here to offer an update on the mid-session summit. Going to be talking to some JDHS basketball players about this weekend's fundraiser for Cancer Connection. Ed Byarski will be to talk about dirt. And Sarah Schaefer will give us an update on the Seafood Fest. That's all coming up, plus Bird Note, music, more. But first, here's National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The South Dakota State Senate is recognizing the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie. It may be the first time a resolution like this has passed out of a South Dakota legislative chamber, but not all support the resolution, Lee Strubinger reports.
Democratic State Senator Troy Heinert is from Mission. He represents portions of the Rosebud Reservation. He says the treaty is a valid legal document the tribes use to establish and maintain rights as Native people. Heinert says it was a chance to educate the Senate body about the treaty.
And some of the language in there is straight from the treaty and how, you know, that was not lived up to. It's still not lived up to today. So it was kind of an education piece, but also a chance for the Senate to say, you know what? What happened wasn't right. This isn't going to change that, but we can go forward. And, you know, it needs acknowledged that the federal government did not live up to its word.
Heinert says that by the Senate passing the resolution, it's a catalyst for more government-to-government relationships between the tribes and the state, or tribes and the federal government. The resolution passed out of the state Senate by a 25-7 vote. One of the nay votes was Republican State Senator Jeff Partridge of Rapid City. He says he voted against the resolution because it had outdated language in it.
The way the resolution was drafted was that we would look, honor, and really implement that treaty. And so that outdated language that's there has really caused a lot of consternation within our state. And so for us to go back to this treaty that, frankly, a lot of my Native American friends complain about, their relationship with the government and the contract with the government, or the lack thereof, or the lack of follow through, or whatever, seemed like something that was not in place for us to do.
Resolutions are used to express the opinion of a legislative chamber. They're not legally binding. I'm Lee Strupinger in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The spokesman for the company behind the Pebble Mine proposal in Alaska says the project is forging ahead despite two recent setbacks, including a letter calling for financial withdrawal from a key investor. Dacia Eaton has more.
In the letter dated January 29th, California Treasurer John Chung calls on First Quantum to, quote, immediately undertake all measures necessary to sever any connections, financial or otherwise, with the Pebble Project or its owner, Northern Dynasty Minerals. Chung cites the project's threats to the environment, to fishing, to the economy, and to the indigenous peoples of Bristol Bay. The state of California holds the two largest pension funds in the United States, totaling $570 billion. Mike Heatwool, a spokesperson for the company representing the project in Alaska, Pebble Limited Partnership, said from his Anchorage office that his company has never heard from Chung on the matter.
They have never spoken with us and have no idea what our current project is all about. Their characterization of risk in the letter is wrong, and we are formally going to extend them an invitation for a briefing.
In December, First Quantum announced an agreement with Pebble for an initial $37.5 million investment to support the project as it works through the environmental permitting process, with potential for future investments up to $150 million. Northern Dynasty filed a permit for a scaled-down version of their project at the end of 2017, which is now under review by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Chung's letter came one day after EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt expressed concern about the project's risks to the environment and said he would keep the agency's proposed restrictions for the mine on the table as the project moves through permitting. In Anchorage, I'm Dacia Eaton.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Quantic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by the law offices of Sanofsky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Monkman, a national tribal rights law firm with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Support by the Heard Museum, hosting the 28th annual Hoop Dance World Championship, where you can see more than 70 talented native hoop dancers vie for the championship title February 10th and 11th. Details at heard.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
It's a pretty hazy winter day here, and Andy Klein back in the studio with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Thanks for joining us, and right now entomologist Elizabeth Graham is here. She's from the Forest Service. You were saying you're from kind of a special division of the Forest Service, right?
Yeah, I fall under part of the Forest Service called State and Private Forestry.
And that allows you to take your studies past what would be kind of a fairly arbitrary border in the forest.
Yeah, exactly, because unfortunately insects and diseases really don't recognize our boundaries and borders that we make up. So
right.
By working under state and private forestry, we're able to look at the forest as a whole and able to respond to technical requests and things that occur outside of the national forest.
Yeah. So describe your kind of your everyday job or what your job kind of entails. You're someone who's you study spruce trees, but you study really a relationship that spruce trees have with insects in particular?
Yeah, well, so tonight I'm going to be talking about the name of my fireside chat is What's Bugging the Spruce, and so I don't only look at spruce trees.
Okay.
My focus is on forest health, and many of the issues that trees have are caused by insects, and so my specialty is, as an entomologist, is to focus on the insects that cause damage to our forest. And so today I'm going to talk about various species that we have in the spruce. And, you know, there's ones that people are pretty well aware of, get a lot of attention, like the spruce beetle, for instance.
Sure, that was the first one I asked you about.
Yeah, you hear about that one in the news quite a bit.
Right.
But there's many other things in our spruce trees. And so today I'm going to just share lots of photos and describe the different creatures we have, the whole community living in our thicket spruce.
Right.
And,
so you have a job that I think that there's a lot of us when we were kids, we were like, I want that job, right? And you just stayed in that field.
Yeah.
Is that kind of how it happened? Like, were you always fascinated by insects and things like that? Or did it develop later? Or how did that happen for you?
You know, I would say it developed more later for me because I was always interested in working outside. And, you know, I'm from Chicago originally, and we don't have a lot of forest there. And when I really just wanted to get out and work in the woods and be out of the city, and that was always what I wanted. And once I started studying forestry, I learned what a crucial role the insects have in the forest. And, you know, for instance, the spruce bark beetle or other bark beetles are tiny, tiny little beetles, you know, the size of a Tic Tac, and that's a large bark beetle. And yet they're able to kill these giant trees.
Right.
And so I just always thought, what a cool thing that is. And they're able to adapt and adjust to so many different ecosystems. So I really just wanted to learn more about the insect side of that. And so I had to continue to go to school again study entomology. So
now you were saying one question I was going to ask you is like, what's the weirdest insects you deal with? But you were talking a little bit about the spruce aphid. That sounds pretty weird.
Yeah, well,
they have some really neat
ways to street aphid is actually a non-native insect here, and it's considered an invasive pest. And one of the reasons why it's invasive, why it's able to be invasive and be so successful, is that they do something that's incredibly weird in the insect world, which is to give birth to live young.
And also, it's all female.
Yes, and so they are able to reproduce asexually, so no mating involved. It's entirely female population that we have here. And when the conditions are right, they lay live aphids. And so no eggs or anything like that. In the insect world, that's incredibly uncommon.
Now you're saying that it's females in this population, this kind of exotic population that lives here, but in the European population, are there males and females? Or how does their life cycle differ in the Europe in their native land?
Well, they're native to Europe, and there are males there, but they play a very small role. And usually they only will reproduce sexually by mating with other males during migration periods when they're trying to expand into a new area and have a more diverse gene pool. But when they were introduced over here, as far as we know, it's only the females that arrived.
It's almost like a clone or something in a way.
Yeah, very
right?
similar. Yep.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah.
And then you're saying that one thing that's a concern with a lot of with this insect population and maybe with others is mild winters versus harsh winters. The life cycle is allowed to really kind of go out of control potentially.
Yeah, no, that's another reason why spruce aphids have been so successful here is that they actually are active during the wintertime when there's very few other things that are active. So there's no spiders or lacewings or things like that that are going to eat them and control their population. But also because they can reproduce so quickly, it only, you know, they can reach adulthood in just a matter of weeks. And so if we have mild winter conditions where temperatures are below freezing, they're able to feed and, you know, grow. And within a couple weeks, they're starting to have babies of their own. And so you can really have a small population turn into a very large population very quickly.
And then what do they do to the trees?
So they actually they have mouth parts that are sort of like a straw. And so they pierce their mouth into the needles and actually start drinking the sap or the foam from the needles. And eventually what will happen is the needle will turn yellow at first from the injury from the mouth part, and then it'll start to turn brown as it dries out, and then they'll move on to another one. And so they actually will only feed on the older needles, and so the tips of the trees will have the new growth, and that'll be nice and green and sustained, but the older ones will get damaged. And so typically they don't actually kill the spruce, because they still have that new growth, but they can, you know, severely stress it, and it's not going to be growing very much because they're losing all those older needles.
I see. Yeah. So of the insects that are involved in this environment, what are like your top five or something that you keep an eye on, or what are some of the top ones that you are most concerned about or interested in?
Well, I would say the one I get called about the most is the spruce aphid, and people, especially here, are very well aware of it and notice it quite a bit. And we get a lot of calls about that, the damage, and when the trees look really brown, you know, you kind of see that. It's hard to say which are the worst or
most interesting
which do people
to you
notice
or,
the most. Yeah.
Or just that kind of thing.
So the spruce beetle is another one that it gets a lot of attention. And up north, it's of major concern. Spruce beetle is a native beetle here. It occurs throughout the range of spruce, and we can find it in our forest here, but fortunately, because it's we have a very healthy forest and it's so wet here, the spruce beetles don't do as much damage as they have elsewhere. So that's one positive that that we don't have. I don't get as many calls about spruce beetle here, but you know, if we were talking about that's just sort of the spruce agents that I probably get the calls about the most. There's also several gall makers that are on spruce trees that people tend to notice. There's ones that kind of look like a pineapple, and call those pineapple galls, and they don't really cause major damage, but you know, people notice them. And things that are charismatic, people tend to notice more.
Right.
So like with the woolly bear caterpillars, I get calls about those every summer, you know, saying, I've never seen so many woolly bears. And
they've been around for a long time, though?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people have asked me if they're native or not. And as far as I know, they're native to the area. They're just maybe more abundant in recent years. And they have this fascinating behavior right before they're going to pupate to turn into, you know, a moth. The caterpillars go through this what's called a wandering phase, and where they almost like, you know, frantically have to like burn some calories. And so they start marching and they go across the trails and down the sidewalk and in your street. And that's when people start really noticing them, because they're like,
they're everywhere.
You know, the caterpillars on parade.
Right, right. Wild. Well, it's all part of the world, the fascinating world of entomology, and Elizabeth Graham will be talking tonight at the Fireside talk that happens here at Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center every Friday during this season. It's at 6:30 and 8 p.m., right? And I always tell people to get there early, especially for that 6:30 show, because it fills up really quick.
Definitely.
Got lots of stuff to talk about, lots of pictures, and all those kind of fascinating things. I remember seeing this one weird thing on a spruce tree once. That a lot of that stuff might get answered tonight.
Yeah, and the nice thing about focusing just on the spruce is it really keeps a little more focused, and there's just so many cool things that often don't get attention because they're just not that menacing.
And obviously they are a massive part of our environment here.
Exactly.
Spruce tree health and what's happening with them is something that's going to affect us all.
Yeah.
Well, Elizabeth, thanks so much for coming and talking to us. Once again, it's the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center Fireside Friday speaking series, and Elizabeth Graham is your speaker tonight. Be at 6:30 and 8 o'clock out at the Visitor Center, and have a great speaking engagement tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks.
All right. Welcome back to June Afternoon. Ada Klein with you, and Robert Venables has joined me to talk about the Mid-Session Summit. Robert, thanks so much for coming in.
Good afternoon, Andy.
This is coming up February 13th and 14th. What's going to be happening?
Well, we have two face-to-face meetings during the year. So this is one of them where we come in during the legislative session, and it gives the members in the region opportunity to engage on the issues that are being worked on throughout the year, and then an opportunity to go up and talk to legislators and kind of inform them of what we're working on and discuss some of the challenges from that end. So we've got two full days of agenda items that we'll be tackling.
Yeah, well, so there's a lot to go over, right?
There is a lot. There is a lot. And it seems like every time we turn around, we're trying to squeeze in another speaker here. And really, our work revolves around an economic development plan, a community development plan that has been put together over the last couple of years, where we've reached out, through our committees and through our communities, to kind of identify what are the top priorities that we as a region can work on together. And so each of those committees will be meeting through the course of the day on the 13th and the 14th, and then you know, we'll have a chance to interact and see what next steps we need to take together individually, and then up on the Hill with our legislators.
Is this something, so it's something that's focused on a region?
It really, and that's okay. Exactly what Southeast Conference is we're recognized both as the state's economic development, regional development organization, and the federal government's economic development district. So we work together with our municipalities, the tribes, corporations, the business community. So we have a board of directors that comes partially from the public sector, partially from the private sector. So it's a good bridge building organization to really focus on our mission of activities that promote strong economies, healthy communities, and a quality environment here in the region.
Describe that to me, or explain that to me a little bit, the federal government district. So how is that kind of determined, how is that determined? How is that all kind of figured out?
It's a long process that happened a while back to help the region have a little better standing. There are times where the designation helps when communities or businesses are accessing federal programs within the district to perhaps have a lower share of a match for a grant or loan that's going going forward for their projects. So it just kind of enables us. We have a strong partnership with the Economic Development Administration at the federal level. They provide some planning funds for us that helps us move our work forward. And so it just kind of gives us a little better standing for our members to access federal programs.
What are some of the top priority items that you are expecting to be discussing?
I tell you, one of the top ones, of course, is always the Marine Highway System.
Mm-hmm.
That is something where, Southeast Conference has, about 58, 59 years ago was formed initially to advocate for the formation of the ferry system. And we're very privileged to work with with Governor Walker and Lieutenant Governor Mallott and the administration in being engaged on reforming the Marine Highway System. We can see what the status quo leads to. We've had, over the last 5 years, over $35 million in cuts to the ferry system's budget. And this week, I think it's the first time since about 1962 where we have no ferries running in Southeast Alaska.
And you could see it on the shelves of the grocery stores.
It is tough. You can see it in the parking lots of people trying to get home to their communities. We have folks stranded all over the region. And so it's just one of those things where we think that there are some other ways that the system can be run. There's no fault of individuals that are there. And don't ever take our efforts as disparaging on the current employees that are out there doing the best they can with very old boats. But we see that there are ways that we can move the operations towards more business-guided principles. It's not going to be privatizing. There's a lot of misinformation out there, and so glad to always correct that. But we have the project has its own website that we've been working on. It's amhsreform.com, and we've got one of the things that the governor and lieutenant governor challenged us with was making sure that Alaskans were driving the solution set. And so we've gathered about a dozen leaders from across the state to engage and be part of a steering committee to guide the work, hire the best of the best consultants to give us the information we need and help put it into a set of recommendations. And so we're just going to continue working that forward while we, as a region fight to, continued survival of the system. Right now, we're looking longer term how to keep it sustainable with some predictability. Mm-hmm. So the ferry system is always one of our top, but it's not the only thing we're working on. We got a lot of other things as well, but that's always right at the top of our list.
Give me an example of a couple of the other kind of items you're expecting to come up.
We're in challenging times here in the region, but underlying that, we have a lot of entrepreneurs that are looking at the resources that we have here in the region, and mariculture has great potential for mm-hmm. Southeast Alaska. And so, right now, I think there's like over 1,000 acres of permits that are in some various state. I don't know if they'll all go through, but there's a lot of interest on how we can develop and use the resources that we have around us. And I think that has a bright future for the region as we look for how we can utilize the resources that we have here, even in a more holistic way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's going to be something that's going to be front and center. We talk about more, and of course there's always the issues of the Tongass. You know, how we can find the appropriate level of activities for each of our economic sectors, and manage that in a holistic way to do what's right for Alaskans. That we're by and large a leaseholder, perhaps, of the federal government. The Feds manage about 96% of all of Southeast Alaska, and so they're important partners to us, and we want to work with them. We do have someone from D.C. coming to talk to us on our first day about Tongass issues, and so we're just looking to engage them, the administration, and work with the Forest Service on how each of our economic sectors can continue to thrive and do well by the forest.
Well, how can people participate in this if they're interested in?
You can go online. All the event information is on our website, seconference.org, and we'll be meeting for those 2 days over at the Elizabeth Paradovich facility, the Central Council of Klinkenheide, and the association. They're very key partners for us, and we're proud to work with them together on all of our economic activities. And so they're hosting us for this event in this fabulous facility they have there on Willoughby.
Great. Well, Robert Venerables, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know about it. It's the Southeast Conference hosting the Mid-Session Summit, and that's February 13th and 14th, and more information on that at seconference.org. Robert, thanks so much for letting us know about it, and good luck with the conference.
You.
It sounds like you've got a lot ahead of you there, a lot of work ahead.
Exciting times.
All right.
Thanks. Nothing to go, nowhere else.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. We got some GADHS High basketball players, and Coach Kasperson is here with us as well. Thanks to you guys for coming in. Coach, thanks so much.
Yeah, appreciate your having us on today.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Luke Mallinger's here. How you doing, Luke?
Doing good.
Man, and Colby Hoover's here, your co-captains of the team. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
So you guys got some games coming up, big games, obviously, always thinking about that, always preparing. But another thing that's happening this weekend is you're providing an ability to have some fundraising for Cancer Connection as well. Coach,
correct, yeah. This is the end of homecoming week, and so the girls have some games this weekend, and so do the boys. And the boys' games are against Thunder Mountain, which are always a lot of fun. But we also saw that as an opportunity to do some good with the excitement around the games, and try to raise some money for one of our players' names who passed away recently. Kevin Gamayan graduated for us in 2014, and he fell ill with leukemia, and he had a pretty successful battle with it after, you know, bone marrow transplant, and he was on the mend. And then all of a sudden some things went sideways on him, and he went downhill pretty quickly, and he passed away. And so that just happened in August, and one of the things with Kevin, he went to Floyd Dryden for middle school, and he was friends with a lot of the kids that went to Thunder Mountain. And so he was a great guy for the kids on our team, but he was also great friends with the kids on their team. And so we looked at this as an opportunity this weekend to kind of honor that connection between both programs and try to raise some money in his name to help Cancer Connection. Cancer Connection was there for him and his family when he was going through treatment and everything down south.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, what are some of the things that you guys are going to be doing, Luke?
I know we have some socks that the whole team will be wearing, and they're orange for the color for the leukemia awareness.
Oh, okay, that's the designation for leukemia awareness, is
yes,
that orange color.
Yeah.
That's why. Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
It has his initials on them too, and Kevin always just played so hard, so we know we got to come out and try and play as hard as he did.
Yeah,
it's going to be very hard to do.
Yeah, definitely. Any other stuff that you guys are going to be doing as part of it?
Yeah, I'm just really excited for the opportunity to represent Kevin on this day, and I just hope we go out and work hard for him.
That was kind of, when you think about him as a player, that's like the number one thing you remember, like hard work ethic kind of stuff, hustler.
Yeah,
that
very
was
much
his,
so.
That was his style of play.
Sure,
yeah. Well, tell me a little bit more about, so the orange socks are there, and then people can get a hold of those, or how does that figure into some fundraising effort?
Yeah, so the socks are available for purchase on Saturday through donations. We're not just offering or asking that people donate whatever they feel is appropriate. And one of the things we're finding through social media and everything, this which is beyond my scope of understanding, but this is becoming a really big deal. Like, a lot of people are interested in providing some financial support in his name, and we're probably going to have to do a special order of socks after we sell out at the game.
Well, that's good news.
It's great news.
Yeah.
And that's, we've set a goal to try to raise $5,000 in his name. And I would imagine we're going to be able to do that just based on what I've heard leading up to this weekend.
That's great. Well, I mean, it's one of the things that, that these organizations sort of depend on is people remembering the people who were helped by the organization and then making sure that they continue the efforts of those organizations, make. I'm sure this stuff is really still really pretty raw for you and your guys.
Absolutely. And even if people don't know Kevin, the sad reality of cancer is so many of us have been impacted in one way or another through family or friends.
There's not one of us who hasn't been affected in some way by cancer affecting our family, friends, or loved ones. Yeah,
absolutely. So we know that this is going to, touch a lot of people, and we're hoping that they use this as their opportunity to give back if maybe they haven't done that yet. So,
well, let's talk a little basketball. Can we talk a little bit about basketball? Just a little bit. Tell about the game. What are you expecting out of the games coming up this weekend out of Thunder Mountain?
I'm expecting a lot of hustle just because that's always how Kevin played, and I think we want to play like him, play hard like him, and come out firing.
You think there's keys to success against this team, specifically against Thunder Mountain?
Just patience and playing within ourselves.
Without giving away too much.
No, I don't want to give away the whole game plan.
Yeah.
I think patience is a good...
That's very general,
that's
yes.
Okay.
That's good.
How about you, Luke? You got any other keys that you're keeping in mind, like we got to keep this in mind when we're playing this team?
Well, I know Thunder Mountain's kind of always been based around just being scrappy team, getting the ball, and we need to be just fighters, ready to come out strong.
Kind of match that intensity.
Exactly, yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Coach, have good luck this weekend with it. One more time, how can people connect with this? And maybe even if they can't make the game, is there a way they can connect with this?
Right. So if they can make the game, that'll be the best way, because we also have our new scoreboard with a video display monitor on it that we're going to be doing a lot of different things through the evening as part of our program. But if they can't make it to the game Saturday night, then they can go to our website, jdcrimsonbears.com. That's all one word. And about halfway down the page, there's a big flyer talking about our night, where it's got a hashtag on Twitter for Kevin. It's hashtag socket to cancer, because we're using the socks. And so they can go on there and donate, and we will be able to track that, and they can leave us a note. Like, if they do want a pair of socks, then we will certainly honor that request. And it's all secure through PayPal and everything. The donate feature is secure through PayPal, and they can choose as much as they're willing.
It's an awesome way to remember a really special person, and then also to give to an organization that does a ton for all those folks that are suffering through this here in Juneau. It's once again the Cancer Connection fundraiser happening in conjunction with the games that are happening this weekend with JDHS. And if you're going to want to get involved on social media, hashtag socket to cancer.
Correct.
That sounds like a good, fun way to get involved with that. And then jdcrimsonbears.com.
That is where they can go to donate.
Okay, sounds great. Well, Coach and players, good luck this weekend. Have a great patient game out there. And good luck against Thunder Mountain. Thanks for coming in.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
comes from the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, helping to reach educational savings goals. Save in Alaska. Study anywhere. Information at uacollegesavings.com.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein with you. Sarah Schaefer is with me now. And Sarah, thanks so much for coming in.
Of course.
Talking to us about this really fun event that is like a big deal every year for K2 and for all the stations here. The Seafood Festival!
Whoop, whoop, whoop.
You guys do Taku Fisheries supplies a bunch of amazing product to you guys.
Mm-hmm.
And
this year also, Spot Prawns from Hoke Seafood Company.
Oh,
yes,
all right.
We've expanded a
little
bit.
Wow.
So, and that's a really, I just picked those Spot Prawns up yesterday. That's a really nice.
That's really cool.
That's something else, I
thought.
It's
so great for us to be able to have this amazing local resource.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I know. And I had a chef talk about it the other day. We have the best seafood in the world. It's really true.
It's really true. And it's one of those things, as a traveler, sometimes it's amazing. I've been to different places, and you're like, oh, there's seafood here, and it's always like, meh, meh, meh.
I know, right? I know.
Small thing compared to ours, you know?
No, you know, it's really unbelievable. And when you especially like those prawns, and I mean, I love rockfish personally.
Yeah,
I really,
the clean water and just that pristine nature.
And
that
the sweetness, like everything has a sweetness to it that is, I think, distinct for the water here. So. And the chefs love to cook with it, so that's what we're going to feature.
Well, let's just give an overview here. So the Seafood Festival, just if by some miracle someone hasn't heard about this yet, explain it to folks.
So it started as I'll give you a little historic overview because that's fun to see how it evolved. We started as a salmon cook at the Yacht Club, where
it was a halibut feed, I remember it being.
Oh, maybe that was what it was. You would probably know.
Yeah, it had to do with, before IFQs, halibut just came in and these huge, big, you know, catch happened. And so everyone had halibut.
Uh-huh.
So we were gifted then some extra halibut, and then we'd given halibut feed. And then it started being salmon as well.
Mm-hmm.
All at the Yacht Club, you're right.
Right, back
then,
it was at the Yacht Club.
It was at the Yacht
everyone
Club.
At K2 was summoned to chop up vegetables, and that's what it was. And then over the years, it's really grown to local restaurants showcasing their skill set. Then we moved to the Jack, and now we've been at Centennial Hall. I think this is the third year in a row, and it's really a culinary showcase event. We don't do an auction this year. We really try to focus on what this is about. It's about raising funds for public radio and to enjoy incredible food. Seafood and desserts. We'll have cookies, and we'll have local ice cream, too, that's included in the price. We have, of course, Alaskan Brewing Company that graciously is doing a private beer tasting. I say private because there's limited seating, and that's always the best part that sells out.
It sold out, I think, right?
Oh, it sold out 3 weeks ago?
Yeah.
So that's like, because you start with a beer tasting, and then you eat all that good seafood. So beer tasting sold out, but we still have very, very limited seating available for the actual event. And that is basically at 6 o'clock, we open the doors, and we have 8 restaurants that basically are cooked their seafood dishes, and they will dish those seafood dishes up for you.
Yeah, awesome.
We have a menu printed out.
I see this menu. So it's Sawana Cafe, Bee's Cellar Door, The Breeze Inn, TK McGuire's, Hangar on the Wharf, McGivney's, Saffron, and Raven Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And then desserts by Copa, Breeze Inn, and Heritage Coffee Roasting.
Yep.
And side dishes by Breeze Inn.
Yeah, sides by Breeze Inn.
So all this is sort of like the all-stars. It's like Murderer's Row of the great restaurants here in Juneau, all lining up to provide amazing. So they get this great, it's almost like a Chopped episode or something,
right?
I know. Like, here's your ingredient. Go make something, right?
I know.
And they all go do something amazing.
It's fun. So yesterday I delivered all the seafood, and then 2 days later they come and they prepare what they've prepared. And it's really also like it shows the wide variety we have, right?
Yeah.
We have Filipino food. We have Thai food, and we have, of course, local food from here that is, you know, Juno-inspired. So it's really, it's a fun event. And then
cool.
We have Salt has graciously offered to host the bar for us. It's a no-host bar, but Amalga Distillery is going to be featured with their G&T, and, of course, Alaskan Brewing Company.
Yeah, so. I got to be involved in that a little. And then I also get to team up with Sean McLaughlin, who's our Southeast sales manager, and he and I are going to be doing this tasting.
So
that's,
tell me.
Right? That starts at 5. Starts at 5.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to be, should I keep a little bit of it
teaser.
Secret?
Do a teaser.
Well, we're going to do a very sprucey beer. That's pretty fun because it's a local ingredient that we really know spruce. So we are kind of recognized. In fact, I'll just say we're going to be doing the Spruce IPA, which we just 2 days ago won a craft beer craft beer and brewing award.
It's
a gold
hard to
medal.
Get in town. You know that, right?
Yeah, the Spruce IPA.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's at the brewery. You can get it there. But you also, I think it's definitely been at Fred Meyer and other places like that as well. Anyway, then we got a rough draft that we're going to be providing. We've got a barrel-aged, very exclusive rough draft that we're going to be bringing as well.
Lovely.
A barley wine that's barrel-aged. And then we've also got a pilot series that we're going to be bringing. So we've got a lot of different kind of varieties of stuff we always like to kind of bring stuff that accentuates different parts of what beer can be about.
Oh,
you
that's
know?
Exciting.
So, yeah, it's fun. It's always fun for us to do it because Sean and I like to, you know, we like working as a team. It's fun. And then it's a really enthusiastic crowd.
Yeah.
Right? And then you have, like, little snacks usually from Taku and stuff like that, little crackers and salmon jerky and things like that around often. And there's all kinds of fun stuff.
We used to. That is not part of the plan this year.
Okay.
We're keeping it simple.
Crackers, like, at least.
I think we'll have crackers.
Okay. It's good. Crackers are good. They cleanse the palate, you know,
that's
and it's tasting.
Actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
Publix is
Publix. Okay. Yes. No. We will have something there.
All
and
right.
Yeah, that's exciting. That's
yeah.
gonna be great.
Yeah, very good.
And I just wanna give a shout out to our sponsors, which
sure.
is Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute and Pacific Seafood Processors Association that also graciously provide support for this
yeah,
event.
That's great. And of course Hooked and Taku are the ones that have provided
yeah.
that. And Alaskan Brewing, and now along with Amalga Distillery.
Yeah.
So exciting to get some of that going as well.
Right?
That's
going to
be really fun.
So it's not only a food event, it's basically a culinary all-surrounding event for us.
All-encompassing experience. So there are, luckily, a few tickets left, right?
Yes. And today has really been quite something for ticket sales. So we have ticket sales online will shut off tomorrow at 4, and then we will sell the remaining tickets at the door if we have any.
I would just say the one thing is that this is unlike some other events where there's wiggle room on the tickets. Once this sells out,
yeah.
it's sold out because you run out of food if you oversell it, right?
So, I know.
So that's the thing is that folks really should just go online and get in on this right now.
And we've had last year, we had less tickets, but we also had less seafood. So this year we have 60 additional pounds. And, but still, the door will close. We will not wiggle
right.
on that one.
Yeah, unfortunately. When does the actual dinner start?
At 6 o'clock.
At 6, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So the beer tasting, if you've already gotten the ticket for that, that starts at 5. If you haven't gotten a ticket for that, you can't.
Yeah,
sorry.
Exactly.
But the beer dinner starts at 6 o'clock
mm-hmm.
and runs through...
It's 9-ish.
9-ish, yeah, 8:39, something like that, right.
Rob Cohn and friends are going to provide music, so it's really kind of like, you know, it's kind of an easygoing...
It's a fun thing
fun
to be
event,
at. Yeah.
And yes, G&T's from Amalga and good Alaskan beer with that can just, like, clear your palate, too, of all the good seafood. It's going to be a lot of fun. And tickets are online at kto.org.
I was just going to ask that. That's great. Well, Sarah, thanks so much. You're going to have a great event. I'll be there tomorrow.
Yay.
See you there tomorrow. And it's going to be fun. The Seafood Festival happening at Centennial Hall tomorrow. 5 o'clock is the beer tasting, and 6 o'clock is the dinner. Dinner tickets are still available at kto.org. Sarah, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know about it.
Thank you.
All right.
This is Bird Note. From a wooded thicket along the lower Rio Grande River comes a rich, whistled song. Your eye catches a flash of brilliant orange. There's the singer, an Altamira oriole, a dashing bird. Its orange body contrasts beautifully with its black breastplate and eye patch. One of the largest orioles, at 10 inches from beak to tail, the Altamira is a tropical resident year-round, reaching into the United States only in southernmost Texas. And it was only in 1939 that the Altamira oriole was first found north of the Rio Grande. Now, it happily visits residents on the Texas side of the river, especially where juicy orange slices wait in a backyard feeder. Northerly breeding orioles, like the Bullocks in the west, and the Baltimore in the east, are migratory. These orange beauties nest as far north as Canada, but winter mostly in Central America. Their songs, too, are memorable, but no match for the music of the Altamira oriole.
Support for Bird Note comes from Audubon Park Wild Bird Food, family-owned and celebrating National Bird Feeding Month. This is when birds need the most help. Info at audubonpark.com.
Well, as the Pogues play Dirty Old Town there in the background, we're going to talk dirt with Ed Byarski, who's just come in. Ed, thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
And you were just saying, well, dirt's if you don't want it, soil's if you want it. So how do you take dirt and make it into soil, I guess, is the big question.
It is, and what do you start out with? Juneau and the rest of Southeast Alaska has quite a wide range of something. We may be starting with dirt, and it's new dirt because the glaciers just retreated a little while ago, so good soil really hasn't happened, developed here much. So out the road out where I live, North Douglas, there's a lot of muskeg,
okay,
which can be modified with drainage and sand plus nutrients to make soil. And the Menihal Valley ranges down near the airport. That's fairly nice stuff, fairly silty. Material benefits from organic matter, peat added to it. But as you go up the valley, then it turns to sandy, gravelly, bouldery, and there sometimes you're better off just buying some and having it trucked in because you may be more rocks than anything else.
Right, right. So is it something that this time of year people should be sort of thinking about and planning on? Or
kind of. If they have some history with knowing if they've been digging in their yards and whether they already have some material they're gardening in and have some experience with, okay, I know I've got to improve my drainage. I've got to add more. Maybe I'm more on the heavy silt, or maybe you've seen blue clay, which really is a challenge to try to do anything, but that's usually after somebody's scraped off everything off the top. So planning for what kind of soil amendments, how are you going to change or improve your soil to grow better, and that kind of depends on what do you want to grow. And you may need to drain it unless you're trying to grow skunk cabbage and hybrid cranberries.
I guess that's what so I've got a lot of land, you know, and I don't want to do something here with this. Do you decide what you want to grow first before you start thinking about how to modify the soil? Do you figure out what kind of soil you have for?
All good questions. I mean, some folks will start, okay, I've got something out here. I don't know what it has in it. So they may have a soil test done, which will tell you what kind of nutrients are in it, how much organic matter is in it, what is the pH of the soil, if it's acid or basic, and sand, silt, clay fractions, what's in it already. And from there, you can get a recommendation on what will grow in this. Or if you want to grow potatoes, that very acid conditions, which we normally have, that's fine for potatoes or strawberries or raspberries. But if you want to grow carrots and cabbage, lilacs or peonies, and you want sweeter soil, so then you might have to add lime or wood ashes. So soil testing can help. Dig some holes, see what you've got. Does your water come up into that hole as soon as you quit digging? So that'll tell you you need to drain your soil. And, I mean, everybody dreams about having a nice, gentle, south-facing slope. with a rich sandy silty loam. Not too many of us have all of that,
right.
So we have to change it.
Yeah, interesting. So are there other things? So there's the dirt thing. So what are your recommendations? Are someone to kind of get some dirt together? How do they go about getting a soil tested?
Okay, so there's companies. It used to be the Cooperative Extension Service did soil testing and then would make their recommendations. Now, if you contact the Extension Service, they will tell you there's a company that I use and they recommend in Ohio that is very good and quick. I mean, you go out there, you dig a sample of your soil, dry it, send it off to them. They do the testing, and then the results come back, which then you have to find somebody to interpret to say, okay, based on wanting to grow cabbage and carrots, this, what kind of nutrients you have to add, what kind of fertilizer, how much fertilizer you need to change, sweeten the soil, add lime. Or if you want to grow potatoes, you'll add some different things maybe to it. Or if it's good just the way it is, and that's fairly rare because we have very low nutrients in the soil, we have to add compost and fertilizer pretty much yearly to keep at least all these exotic vegetables growing.
Right.
Our spruce trees and alders, you don't need to add anything for them.
Right, they're
they
fine.
Will grow if you stop driving on your driveway. The alders will grow there.
Right.
But if you want to grow all this exotic stuff, which is all the other colorful fruits, vegetables, flowers,
sure,
then you usually have to modify your conditions, raise beds, raise boxes. That gives you better drainage, warms your soil. A lot of clear plastic around here.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
More clear plastic to warm the soil. Again, hopefully Mother Nature cooperates a little and gives us more summer this summer.
Yeah.
That would be good.
That would be
because
good.
We didn't get much last year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, weather, we have to work around the weather.
Yeah.
And whether we have to modify the conditions, again, with a greenhouse or a hoop house.
Right.
Or something like that and change what we've got so we can grow this stuff.
Anything else this time of year people should be thinking about for their gardens?
So thinking about finding, look for, even check what, literally calling the people who, if you want to buy topsoil, it's worth calling those folks to reserve topsoil. Because once by that first sunny day or sunny weekend in late April, early May, I know some of the guys who make the stuff and their phones are ringing off the hook. So you can reserve topsoil to have them deliver 2 yards or 5 yards or 10 yards of soil to make a couple of boxes. Certainly getting, if you're going to be growing anyway, order your seeds or plants or potatoes, seed or whatever. Get them ordered now so they will be ready, so you'll have them when you want to start planting in March, April, May, if you're starting seeds or plants or directly planting into the ground. I mean, that's planting ahead. Or if you're thinking about building a greenhouse or buying, you know, you can buy greenhouse kits. Certainly it's a great time to look at your space that you have. Okay, how big can I build a greenhouse? What can I afford? Most of the greenhouse manufacturers will cheerfully talk a gardener through what the options are and the costs. And then you add shipping to that, because there's always shipping.
Sure.
to get it here. And again, same thing. That takes time, of course.
I mean,
you're looking out there at weeks to month or two. So, again, if you've got a space that you want to improve, there's a lot of potential planning.
Yeah.
And, you know, looking at the different catalogs for seeds and vegetables, all of which are the best and most wonderful and tasty ever, guaranteed to grow.
Right, those things.
Somewhere,
right,
somewhere.
Right.
Maybe not here.
Well, Ed, even in this off season, all this stuff to think about for gardening and for dirt conditioning and all that stuff. Thanks so much for coming in, letting us know about it, and talking to us about it.
You're welcome,
Ed Byarski, coming in and letting us know all about not just dirt, but all the other stuff going on right now. Thanks again.
You're welcome.
And that's it for Juno Afternoon. Thanks so much.
FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210 AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Huna, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on